long-haired weirdos, short-haired weirdos, vandals, hooligans.
Love the government, hug the government, love the government, hug the government, love the government.
Welcome to The Politics Guys, a place for bipartisan, rational, and civil debate on American politics and policy. I'm Michael Baranowski, political scientist at Northern Kentucky University. With me today is my regular co-host, Cleveland area attorney and Republican factotum, Jay Carson. Good morning, Jay. How are you doing?
I'm pretty good.
I'm doing reasonably okay as well, I suppose. And if you're ready, we'll just get
it. I need to come up with a better way to answer that question.
I think it's one of those things where you ask people and it's just sort of a pleasantry because a lot of times you don't really want to know. It's like, oh, let me tell you got 20 minutes, we're here. We're vertical. It's good.
All right.
Well, if you're ready, let's just get right into it.
I'll come up with something clever next time.
Well, you're clever enough during the show. I don't want you to strain yourself or anything, but hey, have at it. Anyway, House Democrats on Friday passed the centerpiece of their legislative agenda, H.R. 1, the For the People Act. I love those titles. Anyway, there are a ton of provisions in it. It's like over 600 pages. But to me, it seems like the key elements are partial public funding of congressional elections, removing various barriers to voting, requiring states to use nonpartisan bodies to redistrict, and also disclosure of dark money political spending. Now, there's a ton more stuff in there. I looked through it. It's packed. Obviously, as legislation, it's doomed because, well, in my view, Republicans know that a more representative government means fewer Republicans in office, and they can't have that. But,
oh, dear.
But well, it's true. But I think it's a good start, though I would say in many respects, it just doesn't go even nearly far enough. But that's maybe another conversation. So, but I think the best way to approach our discussion of this legislation is maybe to look at each of these elements separately. And then, if there's anything else that you want to add in, Jay, we can kind of go from there. Sound good?
Sure. Yeah.
Okay, great. So let's start with public funding of congressional elections. Now, how this would work is that there would be a 6-to-1 match for donations of $200 or less, provided that the candidate raises at least $50,000 in small dollar contributions from at least 1,000 people during a certain qualifying period. And the reason for this is just to ensure that there's some sort of baseline of public support for a candidate. Now, in exchange for this, candidates who accepted the matching funds couldn't accept any other contributions of larger than $1,000, whereas the legal limit right now is $2,700. And that goes up a little bit with every election cycle. And the way this would be paid for is through a 2.75% surcharge on fines that are levied on companies or corporate officers that are convicted for violations of federal law. And also, one thing that this hasn't been reported as much, but it's really interesting to me, is it would also set up a pilot program to give voters $25 vouchers to donate to the candidate of their choice. Now, I love this idea. I think it's a great idea for a lot of reasons. Before we get into that, Jay, I have a funny feeling. I know what you think about this.
I think it's it's sort of dreadful. I mean, let me count the ways. I mean, first of all, let's assume that public funding of elections is a good idea. I mean, I think it's troubling that you would use my tax dollars, and I suppose you can say, well, it's not my tax dollars because it's being taken from the fines levied against these evil corporations and so forth, but it's still coming out of the public fisc, right? To support candidates who I don't like, I disagree with. I mean, why should my public money, our public money, be spent for those purposes? Why can't I just have my own money and spend it how I want to support the candidates I want? And everyone else would likewise be able to do the same. That's one of my bigger gripes about public funding in general.
Can I kind of respond to that one?
Yeah.
That'd be okay. So
yeah.
I understand your argument, and I think there's certainly something to it, but to me, the fundamental problem is, and you're right, you can spend your money how you want, just like I can, but as long as the courts say that money is equal to speech, essentially, then anyone with more money is going to have more speech. And so there's a, I would argue, and a lot of people on the left would argue, that there's a fundamental inequality built into the system. And so the little guy, whether that person is a conservative or a liberal or an independent or some kind of wackadoodle, who knows what, simply doesn't have the same level of speech as whether they're rich liberals or rich conservatives. And that, to me, is far more of a concern than the concern you have. And so while I'm not dismissing what you're saying, I think that the overall inequality in political speech is a far, far bigger concern.
But do you think there's an inequality in political speech? I guess that's more fundamental question.
Absolutely.
I think Tom Steyer has made some pretty substantial contributions, right?
Sure, but you can look at individuals. Anecdotes are one thing. But when you look at the overall pattern of political donations,
he's given billions of dollars.
Well, you're right. Individual data points. I'm sorry. That's fair.
All right.
But if you look at overall contribution patterns, it's very, very clear what's going on is that the people with wealth and power are the people who contribute the most and they get the most out of government. And that's the cycle. And it's in large part because of our broken campaign finance system. And so I think this is at least one small step toward rebalancing that, the part I really like is the $25 vouchers to everyone. I think that is the genesis of a great system. I talk about this in my classes, in part because Larry Lessig, who ran for president for like 5 minutes back in 2016, he wrote an entire book about this, and we had him on the podcast a while ago. I think this is the fundamental problem with American politics is the financial incentives are all just so incredibly tilted toward the rich and powerful, and you're never going to get any kind of real change as long as you have that system in place. And so I like the fact that they're attacking this broken system at its root.
Wow. All right. Well, let me go back. And let's say that the voucher part, I would stipulate that is the least bad part of this bill.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. Because again, that's not something where my money is just being redirected to someone else. I have, in that case, that is a pool of money that everyone can use as he or she sees fit.
Okay. I see what you're saying.
I have less of a problem with that than saying, well, because some other candidate happened to raise a lot of money from small individual donors. And I will get sort of a wink to that. It's pretty easy to arrange that. If the concern is big expenditure, big donations, well, we can break that up pretty easily.
That's illegal, but anyway.
Well, it's illegal. Yeah,
that's a minor point, but I mean, yeah, you can't, well, I mean, no, it's a violation maybe, maybe, of campaign maybe law. Well, I mean, it's a violation of campaign finance law for you to, instead of giving, if you want to give $5,000 to break it up into smaller chunks and give it to people.
Have me and my wife and other family members each give $500.
Right. Now, you can do that individually. That's fine. But you can't give that money to somebody else and say,
sure.
And there have been people who've actually been, prosecuted and convicted for doing that. I just want to point out that is, while it's difficult to enforce, it still is illegal.
Right.
Okay.
I would say not difficult to enforce. I would say almost impossible to enforce.
Just about. Yeah. You have to be pretty dumb about how you do it to get caught.
Yeah. So to me, that's sort of, if the idea is, oh, we're going to have all these small donors come and start giving money. I don't see that happening. I think it would be the same big donors. They would just break it up in order to look like small donors. Where else was I? Do we want to keep rolling with the rest of
Sure.
As Mitch McConnell called it, parade of horribles, and I think he's right there.
Yeah. Yeah. The other thing that I think is a bit on this issue is a big problem is this whole the amount of time that members of Congress and potential members of Congress have to spend raising money. Estimates vary, but they tend to vary between 30% and 70% of their time. And if you take a look at like these for new members, both of the parties put together these model schedule type of things. Mm-hmm. And they can be like up to half the time is you will be fundraising during this time. And I don't think people appreciate how much time that sucks up. I don't think anyone, conservative or liberal, thinks that that's how they want their representatives spending their time, right?
Yeah, I know. I think that's a fair criticism.
You know, and so if we can develop a system that makes it so that they don't have to spend 30 to 70% of their time raising money, other things being equal, that's probably a good idea.
Maybe. Let me throw this out though.
Okay.
Don't you think there is something, and we've had this conversation before, I think, in terms of presidential thing. There's something to be said about being able to get contributions. That if no one is willing to contribute to your campaign, you can't get, there's maybe a sense of, well, there might be a reason for that.
Absolutely.
Now,
I agree.
And your reasoning would be, well, it's because it's the entrenched power who wants to keep the powerful in there. And to some extent, you're right. But I think it's different than that. It's also a look, this person is perhaps not a good candidate, shouldn't be running, has no experience. Why should this person be sort of elevated, you know, by receiving a lot of money? Shouldn't there be sort of a, what you call the silent primary, right? Where you look at how are candidates doing, raising money, and that's some level of shows some level of support through various industries. Now, and again, you want to say, oh, well, it's the rich and so forth, but everyone is pretty well represented at the money table, right? I mean, Hillary Clinton outspent. Absolutely.
I totally disagree with you. I think that certain industries and certain people are represented very well, and others are not represented very, very well at all. And that's just.
How about unions?
They're not nearly as well represented as they used to be 20, 30 years ago. Absolutely not.
Maybe 20, 30 years ago, but what's the reason for that?
I mean, and there's a link. I think a lot of folks on the left, including myself, would argue between that lack of representation and the proliferation of anti-worker, anti-union laws. I mean, these things are connected, you know?
Or it's also just that fewer people want to join unions.
Or, yeah, it just could be coincidental. You're right. It just kind of happened at the same time. I don't buy that for a minute. But anyway, back to your point, that's what I like about this provision is that it would, in fact, it wouldn't just be you could just get these matching funds from dollar one, that it has those qualifications. You know, I mean, it isn't an easy thing to raise $50,000 in another $200 amounts from at least 1,000 people. We can quibble over what the qualifying level should be, but that is in fact part of this proposal, and I think it's a good thing for exactly the reasons you outlined. So I'm with you on that.
Okay. Well, I'm confused, but that's okay. We can keep moving on.
Okay. The second big thing is removing barriers to voting. And that there were a lot of things involved with this.
let me just say there's a little bit of question begging in there.
What do you mean?
That there are barriers. Barriers are going to be removed?
There certainly are barriers. I mean, it's actually, well, yeah, you're right in the sense that it does assume that there are barriers, but
I'd like to go register to vote. Who's stopping me?
But of course there are barriers. I mean, you're not going to admit that there aren't barriers. The question is,
yes,
are
I'm
these,
admit
no,
there
no, wait,
barriers.
Hold on. Your question is, are these barriers appropriate? That's the question. You're okay. Not saying there aren't barriers. So there are a number of things here. And to me, pulling out some of the ones I think are most important. Number one, making Election Day a federal holiday. Number two, barring states from voter roll purges. Three, prohibiting disenfranchisement of ex-felons. And four, automatic voter registration. So those, I think, are the four big ones. And again, people might pull out some other ones. But to me, those were the four big ones. And maybe
it would also surprise you, and I can agree with you on a couple of those.
I thought you might. Thought you might. I'm going to guess you're going to agree with me on the ex-felon disenfranchisement, maybe?
Correct.
Okay. Let's see here. Which other one? Maybe the federal holiday?
Yes.
Okay. Well, I'm 2 for 2. So I guess I might know you a little bit. So,
yeah.
Well, that's good. Okay.
Because, again, to me, I mean, and I'll say those are for two entirely separate reasons. For the the felon disqualification, and this is not necessarily a conservative viewpoint or I don't know, any sort of ideological thing. This is just me personally. We have a whole lot of people who are in prison or have been in prison or are going to be getting out of prison, and I think it's in the public interest that they be reincorporated into society as best they can, and that ought to include full participation in voting. Now, I would preserve maybe barring felons if they've been convicted of certain crimes that go to the integrity of the voting system and so forth.
That makes sense. Yeah. And you know, in fact, a lot of states have actually moved in this direction. So this is kind of a trend at state level anyway.
Which would make, you know, again, I would say then, okay, so why do we need a federal law to do it? On the election holiday, look, I'm sort of lukewarm on that. But if I'm looking at this from a purely partisan standpoint, I'd say that probably helps Republicans.
Really?
Yeah.
Because I know Mitch McConnell felt it's like a giveaway to the federal workers and kind of a pro-Democrat thing and that sort of thing. But
well, it is. But to some extent, you know, a lot of union contracts, they already have Election Day off as a holiday. So they're already getting the day off. Why not let the private sector have it, too? Maybe would the private sector necessarily have it under that proposal?
Yeah,
that'd be an interesting question.
Yeah, private businesses could do what they want, certainly, just like they can now. Yeah. But there probably would be that pressure if, you know, there's no mail delivery and all that other kind of stuff.
Well, I take that back then. I mean, I guess that would be my fun amendment that I would throw out there. I would say, okay, how about we make it, you know, everybody gets the day off? Because really, right, if it's that important, that government workers.
That sounds like a poison pill. I mean, we don't have any days like that.
Let's walk this through. If the idea is that having to work on Election Day is a barrier, you know, this proposal would say, okay, well, we'll remove that barrier for federal employees, but not the rest of you. Well, that's not as important for these state people.
But I think that it's because it goes beyond Congress's legitimate authority to do that. I mean, I think it would be a way overreach for Congress to, for the first time ever, to designate a certain day as a day where private employees could not work.
I think you're
stunning.
You're probably right. I'm just, again, it's the rationale.
You do what you can.
I'd be interested. You could still have a resolution saying, and Congress encourages
all employers,
especially private employers, to give their employees the day off to vote.
Absolutely. Actually, Congress could probably do this in such a way using their commerce powers in that indirect way that they do. So, I mean, I think it might actually get struck down. You could envision that, but I think that would just be.
Right. No, you would have to make the argument that there is a here's the legitimate interest, the overwhelming interest in voter participation, and that outweighs the, your private right to.
But onto those other things, the ones that you disagree with a little bit more, I figured you would. For instance, you actually were a big fan, I think, of the recent Ohio voter roll purges, and so I assume that you would.
I'm a big fan of all voter roll purges.
Purge them all.
Maybe we have it's an unfortunate purge is an unfortunate verb, and I think that was one that was chosen by the media and the Democrats. But first of all, that's something that has been required in law in most states for forever, right? If you see if these people are still actually alive, one. Two, living where they say they live. And the way you do this is, and you and I can say, look, maybe you need more stringent regulations on making sure you don't accidentally purge someone who shouldn't be purged. But, you know, the Board of Elections sends them a postcard and says, hey, are you still there? Do you want to still be registered? And you respond or you don't. If they don't respond, then there's a follow-up letter typically that says, hey, just letting you know, if you don't respond, you're going to, you know, not going to be able to vote. And these are all typically done in fairly, you know, good lead time ahead of an election so that you still would have time to either you know, respond or if necessary, right, register again. And it, what this does is it defends the integrity of our elections, that you don't have lists and lists of people who just don't either don't exist or don't live there. And, you know, I'll tell you what the danger, of course, is if you have those people on a list, it's pretty easy to get an absentee ballot for them and cast it for them. You have someone go harvest them, so forth. And how can you tell even if they didn't harvest them? But, you know, again, there's been cases in Ohio, I think it was Ohio. I don't know, it might have been Maryland, maybe I'm thinking. But no, you had a bunches of people living in you know, vacant buildings. And of course, they weren't actually living there. Just they had at some point had a residence or been registered there. And they should have been purged. So, you know, and likewise, the whole Georgia thing, that was the big cry that all these folks were somehow disenfranchised. But to my knowledge, to date, there's been no one who has been able to show up and say, hey, I wanted to vote, but I couldn't.
Well,
because my name had been taken off the rolls.
Let me say this is one where I at least partially agree with you. A lot of it involves how it's done. So in other words, if you just, you know, I could see certainly states could do this in such a way that it has the effect of disenfranchising people.
Right.
Like
if you
they
say we're not going to give you notice, it's, you know, that just sort of.
Or they do it every year or something like that. I mean, I think it's one thing to say, well, you haven't voted in a couple of elections. We're checking in, plenty of notice, that sort of thing. Also, if it's done in a way that, you know, this can be in a way connected with casting provisional ballots and things like that. But I take your point, and I think it's a valid point that, yeah, you have to make sure that the rules are accurate to the best of your ability. And so to me, just an outright ban is not okay, but maybe some provisions as to what kind of acceptable ways of doing this are or aren't. So
right.
I think I share some ground on this.
Yeah, and in most cases, I think most states, and I can't speak to every state, but the places I've looked at, it's more like it's typically like a 10-year review.
Mm-hmm. And that, you know, that kind of thing, I don't have a problem with that, certainly. And again, the devil is always in the details. So
and again, that's saying, look, if you haven't shown up to vote in any election, local, state, national, you know, over the course of two presidential elections, over the course of say five congressional elections, who knows how many local elections, you've never cast a ballot. I mean, shouldn't there be some presumption of like, look, maybe this guy is dead or just doesn't live there anymore. I mean, I think that's not an unfair. And then to say, and you send a postcard or letter saying, hey, you're still there, and you get no response. And then you say, okay, I'm going to strike him. I don't think that's an affront to the Constitution.
No, I mean, with a period like 10 years, I'm in agreement with you on that for sure. Well, what about that final thing, then, automatic voter registration? And I think how this would work, generally speaking, is it can be done through, you know, motor vehicle bureaus and various other government offices where you, I mean, there are various ways to implement it, essentially, but basically you have to opt out, in other words, essentially.
Right. So if the government has your name on a list somewhere, then you're a voter.
Yeah.
Essentially, is how I would.
Yeah.
Again, to me, that strikes me as problematic for a couple reasons. One, having to do with the striking of voter stuff. You can have your driver's license information may not always be up to date, right? It might not be always accurate. If you move a lot, and especially, you know, when I was younger, I mean, I've been in the same place now for quite a while, but when you're younger, you're moving, you know, fairly regularly, right? And you can say, well, I was still in the same state, but you're in different congressional districts, you're in different state house districts, you're in different cities and localities. So it'd be pretty easy to have someone end up registered in the wrong place or the right place. And I think it's just a mess, and I'm not sure what it accomplishes. And it's sort of almost a weird kind of thing of like Democrats on the one hand say, look, we're not going to have any sort of system where you have to show your driver's license. But if you have a driver's license, you're automatically registered.
But it sounds to me like the problem you have with this isn't necessarily the problem with the idea itself, but more of a kind of a technological implementation problem, seems to be.
Yeah, I mean, that's the bigger okay. piece is that technological part of it that I just don't see how it works. And I think it's would open up the door for a whole lot of fraud, or if not fraud, at least confusion. And out of confusion is often born, you know, fraud. It's sort of, that's the opportunity. So that's a problem. The other is it too much to ask people to register to vote when we've done this, when we have this system, Motor Voter, where you can register virtually anywhere. And we've made it easier and easier and easier every year, right? With every reform has moved in the direction of making it easier to register to vote. And yet there's still this idea that Democrats are selling this as, we need to do this to save our democracy. Is there a problem that you talk about these barriers? Is there a barrier to registering to vote?
Well, I mean, you know, it is a barrier. And I think the question is it a legitimate barrier? And I know there are some who would say that, well, yeah, because if you're not interested enough to simply go and register, then maybe you aren't interested enough actually.
Yeah.
Yeah, essentially. And I get that argument. It's the same argument against same day registration, which is another part of this that we didn't get into. But to me, the other side,
same day registration. I mean, that's that problem. And also, fraud type issues, because how do you can't verify. Yeah.
And I'll just point out, we won't get into this again, because I mean, we've already gone along on this, but you know, we've talked about this before, Jay, is that I will stand by, I know you can pull out instances where there were questionable registrations and things like that, but I will point to the academic research on this, which shows that verified cases of vote fraud are vanishingly small. And you and I, again, we've gone back and forth, so that's your view, and that's my view, and that I think encapsulates some of the conservative liberal split on this. And so I think that's an important point out. So fundamentally, we're kind of coming at this from a different view on how big the problem is, you know. And I essentially feel it's non-existent, just about, and you disagree with that. And of course, given that, we're going to have different views about making voting easier or removing barriers.
Right. That can be another one for one of the extended dialogue thing.
So next, it focuses on addressing the issue of partisan gerrymandering. And how this would work is that states would be required to use nonpartisan boards to draw congressional districts. Each commission would have 15 members, 5 Republicans, 5 Democrats, and 5 independents. And all the plans would require not just the majority of the entire panel, but at least one yes vote from a Republican, a Democrat, and an independent, essentially. So,
and who would appoint the panels?
I looked into that, actually, and it was, I must have spent an hour trying to find the details of that in the legislation. And all I could find is that they would be chosen at random from a pool of qualified applicants. Now, what does that mean? I don't know. But yeah, I wondered that, because that's a huge question, right? And so there's, I think, sort of in theory.
And again, chosen by random by whom?
Yeah, I know. And that's a fair question. And that's why I spent a lot of time trying to find this in the legislation itself. And I could not find it anywhere in there.
Granted, it's
hundreds and hundreds of pages. So maybe I missed it. I don't know. But putting that aside, I'd like the general idea of nonpartisan boards, depending on how they're drawn up. Putting these districts together, I think that's a good idea. What do you think about it?
I would say in a lot of cases, different states have taken steps to do this.
Yeah, not a lot, but there have been a few, and mostly out west. But yeah, there have been a few.
And there have been sort of citizen, whether it came from the state legislature or citizen initiatives, have done something like this. But there's still at base some political accountability at the end of the day. And I've said this probably a zillion times, that it would be nice if you could say that this should be a completely nonpartisan, non-political decision, but it is. And it always is. And it, by necessity, there needs to be some political accountability for that. I would not disagree that gerrymandering is a problem, but I don't see that this is the solution to it. I think what you get is just sort of the same variation. It's you can't take politics out of this process. We don't have there is no completely neutral, you know, Solomnic sort of figure who can just decide this. It is always going to be political, and I think sure. The better route is to recognize that it's political
and just throw up our hands and say this is how it is. I mean, I disagree with that.
But again,
I think you can make it less political, and this is what a lot of these independent boards have been able to do. They don't take the politics out of it entirely, but I think this is so central to representative government that if there's a way to minimize the politics, not eliminate it, because you're right, but if there's a way to minimize it, that should be seriously considered and implemented if at all possible. And so I'm very much for this.
Okay. I guess my question then, why does it have to come from the federal government? And secondly, I'm not sure that's even constitutional.
You know, that's a good point. There are some constitutional issues with this, and I think you can make a good case that if push came to shove, well, yeah, I mean, it's not a slam dunk. It's unclear as to whether, depending on how this were, you know, ended up being put into legislation, if it would in fact pass constitutional muster, maybe not right. With this court, but I'm saying
that just so for the listeners that, I mean, the Constitution assigns questions of running elections and voter eligibility and so forth to the state government.
Right. And it's, I think there are ways.
Absent the provisions of 14th, 15th Amendment, subject to those provisions. Yeah. But yeah.
I think there might be ways this could be done where it wouldn't run into those problems. But you're right that could be an issue. But you're not necessarily against then states doing this.
No, I have less of a problem with states doing it because, again, I think there's going to be more accountability at some point, because the way most state constitutions operate, at some point you've got to have a legislature approve either the recommendations of the commission or something like that. You don't just have a completely isolated commission that says, here are the results, here are your districts.
Well, I mean that's sort of short circuit that sort of defeats the whole purpose.
No, not necessarily, because there's a political pressure then, right? If you have
what's the pressure? Explain this to me. I don't see what the pressure is, but go ahead.
Well, because we did this we did this bipartisan in Ohio. If you have a legitimate nonpartisan board, right, that comes up with here are these districts, and it goes to the legislature, and you can have either, you know, both sides of the legislature, both parties say, look, we think this is a fair deal. We're all going to approve this. Well, that really adds some legitimacy. If, on the other hand, you have one party that says, no, this is a complete sham. Well, there you've got that. So I think
that's going to matter. The public's going to rise up over this issue and say, yes, redistricting reform now, my God. I think that's incredibly naive, Jay, I gotta say. But no,
why so? Because they have in various places, right? In various states, they've done this redistricting reform.
They've done it, but this idea that essentially the partisans who are running the state government are gonna care what out party says. I mean, the way these states have mostly done it has been through, correct me if I'm wrong, have been through citizens' initiatives, because the legislatures don't want to do this because they know where their bread's buttered and they want what's best for them, not what's best for the state.
Well, yeah, but here's the thing. I mean, this is the question that I always come back to, is either you want elected government or you don't. If you're going to entrust these fundamental pieces of a government to folks who aren't elected and aren't accountable, do you have a democracy anymore? Right? I mean, look, I'd rather have the legislature vote on this, even if it's a legislature I don't like as the other party, and approve the districts, as opposed to just have the commission approved it. What if I don't like that? Well, tough.
Well, again, I think you can design. I see what you're saying. I think you can design it in a way where the commission, you know, certainly is appointed by, depending on how it works. And that, you know, again, I didn't see the details in that, but that is obviously a big part of that. And certainly we have bipartisan and independent commissions in other areas. And I don't sure. think it's, you know, when certain things that are critically important like this. But
they also, though, I mean, that would require, in many cases, changes to the state constitution
right.
as well.
That's a good point. So then finally, before we move on from this, the last major element that's gotten a lot of press is requirement of disclosure for large donors. I think it was in this bill, it's anyone over $10,000 who give to any kind of dark money organization, super PACs and various other things.
Like this podcast.
Yeah, exactly. Where,
I'm being completely serious. I mean, this would qualify, although we don't have any $10,000 donors yet.
Not yet, yeah.
Wink, wink. I mean, if you're interested, now's the time before they outlaw
you. There you go, yeah, get in now.
But look, this is the politics, guys, is a corporate entity. It was set up as such because that just makes a whole lot of sense for the bookkeeping.
Mm-hmm.
And what we do could very much be considered. What's the phrase
is
in the bill?
Advocacy?
Not advocacy. It's what they've done is they've kind of broadened it. You know, it used to be you couldn't do advocacy, express advocacy, which
right.
is like vote for this guy.
Right.
But you can still do the look. I think Mitch McConnell's a weasel. That sort of thing.
Yeah.
Which you do, and again, you're free to do that without the government intruding, but this broadens it to sort of like I think it's campaign disco. Pull this up.
Well, while you're doing that, I just want to say that I actually am going to take a position on this. Some people might find surprising is I don't like this provision. I feel that we have a long tradition of anonymous political speech in this country, dating way back from, Publius and those sort of Federalist papers.
Massachusetts Farmer,
And so I think that's important. I don't think I should be required to reveal my identity. And I think people should say, well, the fact that you're not revealing it, maybe I'm going to read something into that. And that's perfectly fine. But to me, this makes me uncomfortable for that reason, but also I don't know that the whole transparency thing is as powerful as a lot of people think it is actually. So I'm not crazy about this provision.
All right. Well, that makes me feel better because to me, that was probably the biggest problem with this is that, and then it's a government sort of highly regulated. I mean, just the idea that and this is sort of flummoxes me that we're calling this is we're saving democracy, but sort of what it will be is mandatory campaign contributions for us, mostly the incumbents, we're going to tamp down on any sort of speech that might challenge that. So to me, I think this is the absolute worst provision. And it's a danger to free speech. I think it would probably be found unconstitutional if it ever passed, and it's not going to pass.
Yeah, it certainly won't. But, and we've spent probably more time on this than any one single story. But to me, there's a good reason for it because this drives me nuts, Jay. I listen to a lot of,
we got to do it before they shut us up.
I've listened to a lot of the 2020 Democratic presidential hopefuls, and they have some great ideas as far as I'm concerned, but so often I think, the basic problem is kind of the plumbing, the infrastructure of this. And you can have all these great ideas, whether they're conservative or liberal, but if the basic structure of the representational process is deformed or broken, it's not going to happen. And I believe in a lot of ways that basic structure is broken. And I was so happy to see the new House Democratic majority recognizing that and making it the cornerstone of what they're trying to do. And I take issue with how they're doing it, but the recognition of that I think is great. And I was just so happy to see them push for that sort of thing.
Well, I'm glad it made you happy. And my observation would be, the House just, or the Democrats just took back the House, right? So how exactly is the system broken?
Well, I think the system's broken in the sense that if we had the truly fair and representative system, the people
Democrats
in Congress
would control everything all the time. Then the system would work.
That tells you something. I mean, yeah, well, you know, it tells you something about what the people want. So that's too bad.
I get it.
If I were the out party, I would rig the system too. You know, maybe. I don't know. But yeah, I think that's the argument. And you may not like it, but I think that's the truth anyway.
My point is, if you can flip power in a House within 2 years, then, you know, the system works. People's voices are being heard.
I see what you're saying, but not really. I think in part, no, let me explain. I think in part it's the sort of Democrats who get elected and the sort of things they can and can't do, because so many members, both in the Democratic and in the Republican Party, are essentially hostage to big money interests, you know, and that's where I think Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders are absolutely right. And so a lot of the things that they want to do that I think are good ideas, they just won't be able to do, because just because you have a D next to your name doesn't mean you aren't essentially dependent on this small group of rich people and big corporate interests. And so, you know, I think that's a fundamental problem.
I'll defend the big corporate interests again, just to the extent that these are the people who create jobs and essentially furnish our economy. So, but we got to move on, because gosh, we had a lot of other stuff.
Yeah. Moving on to something totally different. In response to recent remarks by freshman House Democrat Ilhan Omar that a lot of people saw as anti-Semitic, the House this week overwhelmingly, I think there were 23 no votes, all Republicans, approved a resolution titled "Condemning Anti-Semitism as Hateful Expressions of Intolerance That Are Contradictory to the Values and Aspirations That Define the People of the United States, and Condemning Anti-Muslim Discrimination and Bigotry Against Minorities as Hateful Expressions of Intolerance That Are Contrary to the Values and Aspirations of the United States." Okay. Now, that, of course, came after a lot of...
That was the second version of the bill.
Yeah. There was a lot of debate in House Democratic ranks about how broad it should be. It ended up being very broad. I read the entire resolution, 7 pages, had 25 whereases, and it mentioned Japanese internment, the Dreyfus Affair, Martin Luther King, JFK, a bunch of other stuff. One of these whereases was actually kind of questionable to me. So a lot of them were just kind of like boilerplate things that you, well, just, yeah, I mean, a lot of them were just like, you really need to include this, but okay, fine, the Dreyfus Affair, but yeah, whatever. I wanted to read
the
this
Dreyfus Affair is probably the one you'd most need to include. But
well, I just think you need to necessarily, I think the whole thing could have been done in a much simpler kind of way, but.
Right. They could have condemned anti-Semitism.
You know, I just, yeah, just flat out. But anyway.
They didn't want to do that.
Right. But this one whereas I think is worth talking about, because is whereas accusing Jews of being more loyal to Israel or to the Jewish community than to the United States constitutes anti-Semitism because it suggests that Jewish citizens cannot be patriotic Americans and trusted neighbors. Now, you know, I agree with that if it's meant as a blanket statement that's just kind of offered up without evidence, you know, saying, well, you know, that person's Jewish, so obviously they care more about Israel, they're not a real American, that sort of thing. Yeah, that I think is pretty clearly anti-Semitic. But if someone is making an accusation of particular individuals in specific instances and they have an argument, then I don't think that's necessarily anti-Semitic. And I think it's important to make that distinction.
Sure.
And here's
was it Jonathan Allard? He was a spy for Israel.
Right. Yeah. I mean, yeah, I remember the case. Yeah. And so in that case,
yeah,
you're
I think
like,
it was,
well,
or John Pollard. Yeah.
Yeah. But it's like, you're, that's not being anti-Semitic. That's
right.
Just saying, well, hey, this person actually did, but yeah.
Yeah. He actually did it. Yeah.
And the one thing that really bugs me about this whole story, which was obviously a huge thing, is that so few of these accounts that I read bothered to include the entire context of Representative Omar's remarks. And I really think that this is important to hear, because when you hear these remarks in context, it's a very, very different thing, Jay.
All right, let's hear them.
Okay. And it's going to go on a little bit, but I think this is super important. What the entire context is she says, what I'm fearful of, because Rashida and I are Muslim, is that a lot of our Jewish colleagues, a lot of our constituents, a lot of our allies go to thinking that everything we say about Israel is anti-Semitic because we're Muslim. And so to me, it's something that becomes designed to end the debate, because you get in this space of, yes, I know what intolerance looks like, and I'm sensitive when someone says the words you use are resemble intolerance. And I'm cautious of that, and I feel pained by that. But it's almost as if every single time we say something, regardless of what it is we say, that it's supposed to be about foreign policy or engagement or advocacy, about ending oppression or the freeing of every human life and wanting dignity, we get to be labeled something, and that ends the discussion. Because we end up defending that, and no one ever gets to have the broader debate of what is happening with Palestine. So for me, I want to talk about the political influence in this country that says it is okay for people to push for allegiance to a foreign country. Now, that's the broader context. And that, to me, is to say that that is an anti-Semitic remark. Now, there are some people saying, well, yes, but she has this history of saying things. And she does. And there is a certain history. But this remark in and of itself, I find it hard to disagree with this remark. I mean, in fact, I think she makes some incredibly important points. And I would think that especially a lot of people on the right who are concerned about this sort of thing would agree with her, although there's the whole Palestine-Israel thing. But it's frustrating. I think it's frustrating because I agree with a lot of what people say about a anti-Palestinian bias. We've talked about this in the past, but there always does seem to be this quickness to say, well, that's anti-Semitic. And I think she's right that often too quickly ends the conversation. And all that, right, to is the bigger issue.
I think we have a call from the ADL on line one.
Yeah.
Here's the thing. Up until she gets to the point of saying there are people who are pushing for allegiance to another country, I think, all right, that is a nice, sensible thing. And you and I would agree that just because you have an opinion on something doesn't mean that you hate people who have a different opinion on it, or that opinion stems from hate. But once you get to that point, once you get to where she says the allegiance to another country, because that is something that has historically been seen as sort of an anti-Semitic trope, right? It's not, she knows what she's saying there. It's not just we can have reasonable differences over our foreign policy vis-a-vis Israel. It's not that. It's using this language. It would be almost as if the vice president were to have, or the former vice president were to have called the former president clean and articulate. Using those words in that setting means something.
That's a kind of dog whistle kind of policy sort of thing you're saying.
It is. It is. It's dog whistle policy. And I think it's important to note, it's also, this wasn't Republicans who put forth this resolution. It was Democrats. It was Pelosi. And it was the other Democrats, the more, let's call them progressives, who beat it back and sort of watered it down to this, look, we're against, we're against hate, which, again, you made the point a little while ago about don't we want a representative spending less time fundraising and doing more time, working? Well, I don't know. Maybe they should have been out fundraising instead of just sort of, we condemn hate. Hate is bad. I'm glad we've done that.
I think, there are at least two issues here. And one of them is, I don't want to say trivial, but is certainly the more sensationalistic issue. And I think, you have a point that she may in fact have known what she was saying. It's certainly possible. And given the history,
this is the third time in 2 months.
And so given the history, but then again, given her history, she's had experiences that inform her views in ways that I'm not saying necessarily she deserves extra or different kind of consideration, but I think so oftentimes with these sort of things, we don't consider the broader context. So for me, the real issue here is not the kind of this sort of internal democratic destruction thing that, you know, obviously the Republicans are loving to see and that sort of thing and taking great glee in, but this idea of, well, the first part of that remark, which I think was been overshadowed, maybe understandably so, by that last line.
But keep in mind, that first part of the remark was responding to the last time she got called out.
I think
we're making other, again, statements that were not simply, I disagree with, you know, our foreign policy vis-a-vis Israel. I think we should, you know, whatever. But we're, again, of those dog whistle type, anti-Semitic trope type.
I mean, what if,
again, it was Pelosi who called her out on it.
Well, let me ask you this. So and for many people, maybe not many people, but certainly for some people, it's more than just feeling like I disagree with our policy. There are people who feel that because the pro-Israel lobby is so very well funded and so influential in their view, it distorts our policy to not really be in our best national security interest and not be in the interest of kind of humanitarian moral interest. But it's, and so, I mean, sure. How do you make that point?
I think that's a fair argument to make.
Yeah. I wouldn't go as far as some people would on that issue, but I think that there are some, at least some points that should be considered without the kind of reflexive, well, you must hate the Jews.
Yeah, but again, it's looking at her more entire body of work. And I want to get back to the idea that she had a, you know, some personal experience in this. And I'm not sure I follow that. Jonah Goldberg had a wonderful piece on this that, you know, look, if you had she grew up in Somalia. She was a Somalian refugee. She spent time in a refugee camp in Chad. And it sounds like had a pretty miserable childhood. So in that case, you know, it's sort of like to say, if I grew up in the slums of Haiti, I get to bitch about the Irish. I mean, what's the connection, you know, that is there to say, well, I had a hard time, you know, growing up. So therefore I have the right to take these, you know, say these things that again, it's not as if she's some college kid, right? She's 37 years old. She's been around politics for a while. She knows what these things mean. And the other thing that I would point out, there was a guy about 20, 25 years ago who said similar things and was pretty much thrown out of his party, and that was Pat Buchanan.
You know, Pat Buchanan went way farther than that, I seem to recall that. I mean,
well, no, I mean, he made sort of the same point was the, you know, the Amen lobby in Congress.
I see what you're saying on the Israel thing. Okay, Pat Buchanan did some other stuff as well. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah. But I mean, if you think about it, the big, you know, they remember the big National Review issue, they devoted an entire, like, 40-page essay that Buckley wrote about Pat Buchanan and, you know, anti-Semitism, and they came to the conclusion that, look, we don't know what may or may not be in his heart, but the conservative movement cannot defend him against charges of anti-Semitism based on his record. And I think that's sort of, the Democrats ought to take a similar step. And if you look at...
I don't think Representative Omar has quite that much of a record yet on this where we can just kind of...
It's only been two months. She's getting there. But there's also, I mean, if you look at the I'll call it the Corbynism on the left for Jeremy Corbyn, the labor leader in Britain, who has in many cases made similar statements and has sort of cuddled up to folks who we would find to be pretty bad hombres. So
yeah,
and it looks to me that this is sort of that same heading that same way. So
okay. Well, you know,
she'll be back. Well, we'll be talking about her again.
After
this, in each situation of all the remarks she's made and done, each case the punishment or the price she's paid for it has gone down. she will continue to do so.
Well, I hope you're wrong about that. I hope she kind of moderates her language a little bit. I think she brings in some important perspectives and viewpoints, and that can be useful and are worth considering. But obviously, you know, you have to be concerned with how you say things. And I think for a lot of freshman representatives, that is there's a learning curve there. And I hope that that over time that she learns that. So we'll see. But anyway, before we get to our next story, we'd like to thank our newest Patreon monthly supporter, Katie from Las Vegas. Katie wrote in to say, "I really respect your show and your mission. I enjoy political discussion anyway, but this podcast has been very helpful and enjoyable since I recently began teaching an AP government class, and I've been trying incorporate bipartisan viewpoints and respectful debate in my classroom. Thank you for your hard work." So that was nice.
Thank you, Katie. That means a lot. Yeah.
And of course, all of our Patreon supporters get access to our weekly bonus show and my 12-part Nuts and Bolts American Politics series, which I'm going to be part 12, I think, is going up in the next day or two. So
we could totally go out and do a in-person show for Katie's students.
Oh my gosh, that would be so
you and me, and then like weekend in Vegas.
Yeah, yeah. I like
how much fun would that be?
What happens in Vegas State. Anyway, but anyway, if you are interested in supporting the show, becoming a supporter like Katie and our other great supporters, just go to patreon.com/politicsguys or just politicsguys.com/support. Two ways to get to the same place. Okay. Well, Jay, you know, it wouldn't be a week in American politics in the Trump era without talking about some kind of Trump investigation.
Sure.
And here's what occurs to me is when the new Democratic-controlled House convened back on January 3rd, you know, there were a lot of people on the left, particularly further to the left, who were hoping there'd be this sort of shock and awe anti-Trump campaign, you know, it would just fall on him like an anvil on Wile E. Coyote or something like that, and there'd be this quick impeachment vote and, you know, what have you. But House Democrats have really been, in my view, moving pretty cautiously, and I think that's smart in a couple of ways. I think it's smart from a process standpoint because this shouldn't be just some kind of rush to judgment sort of thing. But also, and this may be more of the calculation.
A lot of them haven't made up their minds yet.
They're still on the fence on Trump. It's important to have that process right in place.
Yes.
And so you can think that Trump is a horrific human being without necessarily thinking that he has done things that, you know, require him to be removed from office. But I also think this is smart politically, because if you have this kind of regular, constant flow of investigations from now until November of 2020, that potentially, could do more to hurt Donald Trump's reelection chances than some kind of massive all-at-once effort, basically. And of course, this week, the latest investigation comes from the House Judiciary Committee, which sent out more than 80 letters to people connected to President Trump requesting information about whether the president or his administration are guilty of obstruction of justice, corruption, abuse
or
of
anything.
Powers.
Really.
Yeah, really a lot of stuff.
if you know if he's guilty of anything,
just let us know. Yeah. You know, and you're right to point out that broad scope. And I think it suggests to some people, particularly on the right, that Democrats are basically just conducting a partisan fishing expedition. But other people, and mostly on the left, and I'd include myself in this group, think that this administration is just so totally suffused in corruption that a wide scope investigation is, of course, what you're going to do because it's so thoroughly corrupt. Now, I should also point out that in addition to this, there's that House Oversight Committee investigation of the administration's procedures for granting security clearances, which has been a pretty big issue in the last week. It's been reported that at least 30 administration officials received clearances, even after the people who did the vetting said, this person shouldn't get a clearance, and that this person shouldn't get a clearance decisions included both Jared Kushner, the president's son-in-law, and his daughter Ivanka. So,
And we should point out that I think that's a legitimate area of inquiry for Congress. I think that's something that they got to look at.
And there are two things here, Jay.
Obviously, it's not a crime or anything for him to do over because he's the commander in chief. He can make those decisions, but it could point to some poor judgment. So,
yeah, definitely. And you know, I think even some Democrats have said, "Hey, the president gets to decide who gets the security clearance or not ultimately, but that doesn't mean that we can't at least inquire into the process that he's using. And the administration's viewpoint seems to be, at least on this particular issue, no, this isn't even a legitimate area of inquiry for you, which I disagree with. And it sounds like
no, I think that that falls pretty plainly under congressional oversight.
Yeah.
The other stuff of we'd like to, you know, investigate all your business dealings over the past, you know, over your life, seems to be overly broad and particularly partisan. And I don't know that there's ever been something that has been this broad. And again, look, you know, Trump's an exception.
Well, you know, there are these unitary executive folks who say basically that anything that happens in the executive branch is no one's business but the president's. And if you don't like it, there are two options. One, impeach and remove the guy. Two, elect somebody else. I mean, and that's kind of the extreme unitary executive position. And right. That's not a position that you hold, but certainly you can understand where Donald Trump and Rudy Giuliani and the whole happy bunch of, you know, folks in there, they tend to be big fans of the unitary executive theory.
But the idea that what they're doing here would be a sort of a de facto grand jury, right? We're just investigating this guy for whatever we can find, and charges maybe can be leveled later. That to me would seem to be outside of, and we're doing it because he's a political opponent.
Well, you know,
would seem to be outside, and these are other people around him who are you know, his supporters, and we'd like to get them too. That's not to say that somebody like a Manafort, which we're going to mention later, shouldn't have been convicted. But I guess is there any, you know, you think Manafort would have been convicted had Trump not been elected president?
Well, no, there wouldn't have been that the Mueller investigation, and so they wouldn't have gotten into basically what they did to kind of, you know, pressure him to talk, essentially. So no. Now, but the larger question is, should he have been convicted? And it's like, well, yeah, I'm glad that
I agree. He did it.
Going to jail. But in fact, you know, why don't we can kind of move right into that, right? Because he's going to jail, but not for as long as a lot of people thought he might, right? 47 months.
Right.
And the sentencing guideline, like 19 to 24 years, something like that. Of course, a lot of folks are pointing out that this district court judge, T.S. Ellis, who was appointed by Ronald Reagan, so he's been there for quite a while.
God bless him.
Yeah, you know, he called the guideline excessive, and he noted that, I love this, Manafort was a good friend, a generous person who had lived an otherwise blameless life. it's getting a there lot of go. Pushback. For, I think, you know, never convicted and blameless life are two very different things. The judge might have gotten those confused a little bit, you know, but I would say he was a totally scuzzy human being who's never been convicted of anything before, but that's a whole different issue. Now, to me, certainly...
Well, we don't increase people's jail sentence for being scuzzy.
No, absolutely not. But, you know, there are a lot of people on the left who have felt that from the beginning, Judge Ellis has had a big foot on the scales for the defense. He's regularly railed at the prosecution for things and basically tried to essentially, you know, again, kind of tilt things toward Manafort, in part because they argue that he felt that this prosecution itself was not so much, I wouldn't go so far as to say illegitimate, but ill-considered, maybe. And so he's kind of overstepped his judicial authority by trying to move for a certain type of outcome. And this is kind of a continuation of that. And I think there's maybe a certain amount of merit to that. Jay, what do you think about all this?
Well, and he might not be wrong. You know, consider that, well, first of all, I guess, you know, one of the wonderful things the left always likes to say is, you know, people shouldn't be put in prison for nonviolent crimes. You know, what Manafort was convicted of essentially boils down to like tax evasion, right? He was right, getting
tax
money.
And bank fraud. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Through these, from the Ukrainian folks. And he was sort of setting up dummy corporations. So they were getting paid and then he was using that money. So he should have been paying taxes on it, but he wasn't, which is all very bad. And he should, be properly fined for it. And, I think a prison sentence is appropriate. But again, I, you know, judge's discretion on, he's going to be in prison. So what, 47 months. So that's, you know, 3.5 years,
yep.
Almost 4 years. That's a pretty hefty sentence.
That's what the judge again, pointed out. Yeah.
You're talking about a non plus again, there, I believe there's going to be, various, you know, seizures of money and, you know, payment and, you know, all that kind of stuff. The taxes he should have paid.
We should also point out that he's still waiting sentencing in conviction he could get, you know, depending on whether they want to have those sentences run concurrently or not, that sort of thing. So,
yeah.
I mean, he could be in jail for up to, you know, up to maybe, you know, 10, 15, not quite 15 years, I think. But
right.
And when you're 69, that's obviously a big portion probably of your remaining time.
And other considerations they look at is how much of, you know, how much of a risk is it, you know, to have this guy out earlier. I mean, he's not a violent felon. The risk of reoffending would probably be pretty low, being that no one is hopefully going to employ him in the same sort of jobs where he could do the same sort of stuff.
One would hope, yeah.
But so no, I'm okay with that, and I think that the judge maybe have a point, and sort of the point I made a minute ago that, look, if Manafort had also and Manafort did not offer up the goods on Trump, which was what a lot of folks were hoping. And you can look at that one of two ways. One is either he is going to, you know, do time for his buddy Donald and be a stand-up guy, which seems to be out of character for him.
Yeah, I was going to say, maybe there's some pardon in the works. Who knows?
Or he just didn't have anything to give up. And as Trump said, look, he wasn't going to lie for him like Cohen did. In order to get a reduced a sentence or to get a deal, essentially, from the prosecution.
Let me ask you this, because I'd like to get your viewpoint on this. Is, you know, so it seems like that the judge just was not crazy that this was brought to trial, that this was, again, illegitimate's too strong, but ill-advised.
Yeah.
But even so, I mean, it seems to me you can make an argument that whether or not the judge personally feels this was an ill-advised prosecution, sort of trying to kind of letting that influence what he or she does on the bench is the sort of judicial activism that is that should give us some pause.
Well, no, I disagree with you there,
okay.
Because this is something where we're talking about sentencing, which is an area of the law.
No, I'm sorry.
I'm sorry.
I should have been more clear. I meant the judge's conduct just in the case itself.
You mean the
essentially.
Whole overcase?
Yeah. That, cause I see your point in the sentencing. That's his discretion.
Yeah, that's discretion.
But
yeah.
But the idea that during the case, as a lot of people say, it just seemed like there was this strong judicial bias against the prosecution, which some people argue was simply because he felt that this was an improper thing to bring to, you know, the court in the first place. I mean, would that trouble you if that, I mean, again, maybe that's true. Maybe
yeah,
that's not.
Improper bias by a judge would trouble me in any event. And I guess the question is it improper? And I'm not sure exactly what all you're pointing to as far as what he did, but a lot of things like evidentiary rulings, again, that's discretionary. That's committed to the judge's discretion. You know, in terms of conduct of the trial and witnesses and so forth, again, that's wide open to the judge's discretion. The judge can abuse that discretion, but the standard for pointing out that a judge abused discretion is really pretty high, right?
Right.
And our system gives judges pretty big leeway in how they run their courtrooms, what evidence they let in, and so forth. So, I mean, you know, that's sort of you know, I don't know, did his conduct rise to an abuse of discretion? I'd say probably not, because look, there's a conviction, right?
Right.
If he was abusing discretion, he didn't do a good enough job of doing it.
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So, you know,
right.
Again, absent, and, you know, I'll say, look, I haven't watched this, you know, day by day, ruling by ruling, but being, you know, holding the state's feet to the fire in a criminal matter, and even suggesting to, you know, that the state might have better spent its time elsewhere. That's, you know, I don't think that rises to abuse of discretion.
And I'm not saying that it's necessarily something he should be sanctioned or anything like that for, but I certainly, you and I think agree on the general principle that that judges should do their darndest to put aside their personal right. views once they get into the courtroom and to yeah. be impartial in their rulings. And I think yeah. reasonable people can suspect at least that maybe that wasn't necessarily the case here, but we'll never know.
Right. Judges should be fair, and as the House voted, hate is bad.
Okay. On that note, well, before we go, though, because we are running a little long, there are a couple of things I'm hoping that listeners can help me out with. First off, Jay, this is weird. We're talking about Trump investigations. Believe it or not, as far as I can tell, there is not one single source for regular updates of like the entire status of all the federal, state, other Trump and Trump organization investigations and lawsuits. And when I first started looking for this, you know, and preparing for this week's show, I thought, well, surely the New York Times or the Washington Post or the Guardian or someone's going to do something like that. And nope, I found a couple of articles that were like summary things. Here we are at this point in time. But mm-hmm. weirdly, there is, as far as I can tell, no, like, you know, regularly updated.
Day by day.
Yeah, exactly. Kind of, which just seems to me to be just really strange, given how, you know, so much of the media is focused on this, but it's not a thing. So it's possible.
That's a lot of work.
Well, yeah, it's possible I'm missing something. I even asked some of my fellow political scientists, and they couldn't point me to anything. So I am asking listeners, if you know of a site like I'm describing, again, not like static news articles, but like a web link to a, you know, to a site from an organization that's trustworthy, that's regularly updated, let me know.
Trump Watch 19 or something like that.
You think there'd be something like that, but as far as I can tell, there isn't. So if I'm wrong about that, let me know. I actually even thought about maybe if there isn't, maybe I should try my hand at putting something like that together. I don't know if people would be interested in that. I'd be curious if you'd like to see something like that. But that's the first thing, Jay. The second thing, I told you this and some of our other supporters, I'm thinking about starting this sort of supplemental podcast just as kind of a way to give my kind of quick take on things that we aren't necessarily going to talk about on the show. Maybe my little rants and things like that. You know, I mean, not a long thing, maybe 10 minutes right. or so most days of the week. It just, you know, I mean, I read the news every day and I have thoughts about things and I have reactions and I want to go off a little bit. So I think I'm going to try something like that. It's going to be more personal than the politics guys. It's going to be, you know, a monologue, not a dialogue. It might be just total junk and be a complete flop. I don't know, but I thought I'd give it a try, see what people think. So, but on the off chance that it is halfway decent, it's important that it has a halfway decent name. So if anyone has a suggestion for a name for this thing, I think I'm going to do, I would love to hear it. Let's hear the creative consensus of you folks. Let me know. And so for either of these things, if you want to weigh in, you can reach us at mail@politicsguys.com. And we would really appreciate it. So with that, we will wrap up. But also, of course, Jay and I are going to be doing the bonus show. And we're going to be talking about, the surge in illegal border crossings, as well as a big a World Trade Organization ruling against China. They have these massive agricultural subsidies that the WTO just said, oh, you can't do that. So we're going to be talking about that. And if you're a supporter, that should be in your podcast app by the time you hear this. If you're not yet a supporter, you can become one by going to our Patreon page, patreon.com/politicsguys or politicsguys.com/support. All right, the executive
producer. Get in before they hit you with that $10,000.
There you go. Yeah, get right in under that. That's very, very important. So we would appreciate it. So the executive producer of the Politics Guys, Michael Baranowski, Jay Carson, Bruce Johnson, Wilmer Moreno, and Benji Fishman. Today's show was produced by Michael Baranowski. We'll be back with a new show on Wednesday. We hope you'll join us.